This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. I use it with my patients at the Hoffman Center all the time. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, the company is offering you special savings of $50 and free shipping. To find out more, go to TryZonaNow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman to get your $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662 or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla. This is an opportunity for you to send us questions via our email, radioprogram@AOL.com. Radioprogram@AOL.com gets you through to us with questions, and together with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, who is heard weekly on our Q&A with Layla and also has a weekly podcast of her own at drhoffman.com. We'll put our heads together and answer your questions. So how you doing today, Layla?
I'm okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good, good. Anything big in the news this week? It's been kind of a slow news week.
It's been kind of a sleepy summer.
Mm-hmm. It is. I actually have an article that I may write more extensively on it. On the subject of salt. You know, salt is something that everybody wants to restrict. There's even an initiative here in New York to ban high-salt foods, or at the very least restrict them, you know, have you know, fancy gourmet restaurants list the salt in each food and thus deter diners from having too much salt. But there's a lot of controversy about that, and some studies suggest that, yeah, that's applicable to some people who have, say, congestive heart failure or have a lot of edema, water retention, or certain people with hypertension, not all people with hypertension. There's an article in, and I'll bring it into the office, you can take a look at it, very interesting. It's an article that suggests that if you curtail sodium drastically, you actually inadvertently will increase markers of inflammation. And it was a surprise to the authors. The authors thought, well, you know, sodium, lots of sodium, that would be very pro-inflammatory. Well, it turns out that when you curtail sodium, that can be pro-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. So what it suggests is that
it can also cause spikes in blood pressure if you go too low.
Yes.
You don't need to.
It's a counter-regulatory thing.
It's like a rebound effect.
Yes, it's a counter-regulatory thing. It's like the body, in an effort to conserve sodium, clamps down the blood vessels to conserve sodium and volume. And, you know, it's sort of a, you know, it's not nice to, you know, fool with Mother Nature, because Mother Nature has these adaptive mechanisms.
Yeah. And, you know, I actually wrote an article, it wasn't that recently, about the DASH diet in reference to sodium, because there are so many proponents of lowering sodium intake, yet there are others who say that can really be detrimental.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying that we should keep it under, 2,300 milligrams a day, which is approximately a teaspoon of table salt.
Mm-hmm.
And other proponents are saying...
I had that by about 9 o'clock this morning. I had about that much because I worked out and I... I actually put a teaspoon of salt, of a Celtic sea salt, into my water bottle, because it's such a hot, humid, dehydrating day that I was sweating bullets and I needed to replace the sodium.
There you go.
So, no danger of hypertension with me.
You have to.
Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. I want to bring to everybody's attention, since we're talking about the dangers of going too low on salt, the DASH diet, the dietary approaches to stopping hypertension, the very popular DASH diet, averages about 3,000 milligrams in daily sodium.
Mm-hmm. Which is actually moderation for some people.
In lowering. Yes, it's moderation.
Yeah.
And it's actually helpful in lowering blood pressure in those with hypertension.
Yep.
So it's not all about the salt.
Yep.
Really.
Okay.
And it's a necessary electrolyte, you know.
All right, so I may write more extensively about that in an upcoming newsletter article.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent.
Great. Well, let's get to questions then.
Okay. We've got an email from Larry. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I'm watching the Mets game.
Okay.
This was back, we got this email back.
My condolences to Larry. My condolences to Larry. I'm very sorry. You know what I heard? I read a very interesting recent article in the newspaper, which said that if they took the players on the Mets who are disabled, and there are about 10 of them on the DL, the disabled list, and they played them against the players who are active, they did a computer simulation based on the statistics of the players who were disabled. Of course, the players disabled, they're disabled, but based on their active statistics when they were not disabled, the disabled team would beat the able team. That's how bad it is for the Mets. Although they still may, you know, as of this broadcast, they still are in contention, so.
Yeah. So, we'll see. Anyway. So, Larry writes, I'm watching the Mets game. This is on Father's Day that he was watching the Mets game. They just introduced the reigning hot dog eating king.
Oh, okay.
I've noticed that over the years, the champion is always a thin man.
Yeah.
You would think the opposite would be true, that a fat man would have a bigger stomach and therefore hold more dogs. I would like to get a doctor's perspective on why the thin man always wins.
Right.
That is
a great question. And, you know, I have to say that from a medical standpoint, I find it kind of astounding, too, because, you know, you think of people who have a big belly having, you know, more practice eating a lot of food. And certainly the potential, you know, you can put more into a gallon jug than you can into, a teacup, right? I mean, kind of counterintuitive that the smaller contestants seem to be able to do it. But actually, this eating thing is kind of not like ordinary eating. It's kind of almost like a form of yoga where you suspend your gag reflex and progressively relax and enlarge your stomach through tremendous training. I don't know why you'd want to undergo this training. And it's sort of a trick to increase your capacity without and overcoming the natural urge to regurgitate and, you know, barf. So that's why it is more about gymnastics than about capacity than, like, you know, physical size. So that's why these highly trained, relatively thin guys seem to do, what do they, like, eat 63 hot dogs or something unbelievable.
I can't watch that because I start to feel ill watching that. And the pie-eating contest and so
forth.
See,
to me, this is so contrary to the spirit of sport because, for me, you know, when I train for an event, you know, I'm training now for a triathlon, and it's a beneficial training. It's like, okay, let's say that on the day of the triathlon there's a tornado and it's canceled. It's all good. You know, anyway, because the process of getting to it was a healthy process. You know, I was incentivized to run, bike, swim, stay active, eat well, not eat junk because, you know,
get
you eat a lot
salt.
Of... Yeah, right. That's one thing,
get
too. Yeah, take vitamins and supplements to enhance my... So it's a good process. The process of training for this eating thing is a very... You know, it accentuates one of the most threatening aspects of American culture, which is overeating, and glorifies it. I don't think this is in the realm of sport. I think to me, it's in the realm of freak show. You know?
Yeah, freak show, self harm.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean,
all of the above.
Contrary to the spirit of the Olympics, because I see these athletes and, you know, what it's done for them in terms of their personal lives, in terms of disciplining them, in terms of the physical benefits that will accrue to them during the training, whether they go home with gold, silver, or bronze. It's been a really wholesome process. But, you know, let's say there was an Olympic, you know, hot dog eating contest. You know, that would encourage the youth of all these countries to do some really bad stuff to their bodies. And not everyone takes home gold.
Right.
I don't get it.
What would you say to somebody who stayed up very late last night watching the girls' gymnastics the American team win because I couldn't stop jumping up and down.
I was not one of those people, but I saw some of it.
I was.
Yeah, and I read about it in the morning, and it was just delightful to watch them. And, you know, I worry a little bit about those kids because they're under so much pressure, and it really changes their bodies and sometimes stunts their growth. You know, the girls become, lose their periods, and they become amenorrheic. And sometimes I worry they almost look a little bit like, I feel a little pity for them that they almost look like trained animals, you know, going through the paces to please a coach, very demanding coach. But I have to say I was, those feelings have evaporated because, the discipline, the accomplishment, what it means to them and their families in terms of self-esteem, and what it means to other young girls and men, who are going to be inspired to train in this fashion. I think it's mostly good. It's mostly good.
Yeah.
I mean, the hyper competitiveness, I don't know, you know, maybe there's some drawbacks to it, you know, where people drive themselves to injuries and they do, you know, they diet excessively so that they look, you know, make a training weight and things like that. You know, that there's some, you know, pernicious aspects to sport too. Especially gymnastics and they're terrible injuries with gymnastics. I mean, just
that's true.
Horrendous, calamitous injuries, unfortunately. But you know,
I think I've seen more bandages on people this Olympics than any other.
Well, you know what you're seeing?
Maybe yeah.
You're seeing those purple bruises. You're seeing those purple bruises. Those are like from cupping. Did you see what's it? The swimmer.
Oh, I saw all those.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The cupping is ancient. I know all about cupping. We used to do this in my own family.
Interesting.
I had a few aunts who were expert at this.
You know, it's interesting.
Oh, this hurts. Come here. Let me cup you.
You're of like a Crimean background, which I guess is not not Middle Eastern. It's sort of Eurasian.
It's Central Asian.
Eurasian. You know, Tatar background. You know. And I'm of a Jewish background, and this is actually part of the tradition in Eastern Europe. And in fact, there's a saying, you know, I don't want to go too far down the line before we get to questions, but there's a saying in Yiddish, which is a saying of the utmost, it means that something is of the utmost futility. And roughly translated, it means that would be about as effective as putting cups on a dead person. And I remember my grandparents saying
very
that
good.
All the time. I didn't know what it was. I knew that it was an expression of like, that is, don't even go there because that's just, you know, that's the person is, or that situation is too far gone. But, putting cups on a dead person, I think that's a really kind of interesting.
You just reminded me of a saying, which is quite hysterical when you translate it to English, and the English is, well, the meaning is, don't do something stupid, and the translation is, don't let a branch go in your mouth.
Don't let a branch go in your mouth. Okay.
In Tatar, it's hysterical. Okay. Anyway. Oh, boy, we digress.
Lost in translation, I think. Okay, let's go to questions.
Yes.
Let's settle down.
Okay.
Right, all right.
Larry, thank you for your question about why is it always the bin man?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So we've got an email from Ken.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Dr. Hoffman, before asking my question, I would like to thank you and Layla for all the terrific information that you're providing in your podcast. My question is this, and you're welcome, Ken. My question is this. I recently read that taking phytochemicals to upregulate gene expression, that pulse dosing may be superior to continuous dosing. And he says, for example, in a mouse study, it was found that a high-dose application of a phytochemical increased gene expression for 10 days, but dosing continued over the next 20 days, gene expression returned to baseline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of this as it would apply to resveratrol, pterostilbene,
that's what I'm thinking.
Berberine.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this kind of goes back to it. We do get this as a question from time to time. Is it better to just continuously take your supplements, or is it better to withhold your supplements and then reintroduce them because then the body is naive to the supplements again? And, you know, we know that this is an effect with certain medications. So, for example, with anti-anxiety medications, pain medications, the longer you take them, the more resistant you become, sometimes with blood pressure medications. And this is called tachyphylaxis. You actually become resistant. So the body adapts to a certain influence, and then gets used to it, and then there's less of an effect. So this does make sense. On the other hand, it's not been completely worked out what that schedule might be. The counter argument is that there may be some benefit to continuous dosing that you miss out on when you take something, say, 3 out of 4 weeks per month. And the other thing I'll point out is that the vast majority of people either voluntarily or involuntarily do that because they either become non-compliant or they run out of supplements. And this happens to me, too. I mean, sometimes, like, I'll go away from a weekend. I hate it when this happens. But I'll be like, oh, my goodness, I prepared all my vitamins. And I know exactly where I left them. I left them right on the counter. You know, I'll see them when I come in through the front door. I was going to grab them and put them in my bag, but, you know. So that's – and then I go, okay, you'll survive. And besides, maybe you'll benefit from that, you know, little bit of, holiday, a holiday. And then when you retake them, they'll be more efficacious. So,
yeah. No, it's interesting, though. So the jury's out on what kind of regimen that would be or how many days on, how many days off.
Yeah.
I also imagine it would depend on the particular phytochemical or antioxidant, too.
Yes, and it might be that different ones have different periodicities to them. Or it may be applicable to some and not all. Let me just comment, though, just add another thought on that why are these people who consume enormous amounts of food thin? If I can backtrack a little bit.
Go back to Larry's question.
Yeah, because one aspect of that is, you know, there's actually a mismatch, as you know, Layla, because you counsel people on diet, between caloric intake and weight, big time.
Yeah.
And there's some people who eat like a house on fire, and they don't gain weight. And I eat a lot and a lot of calories, but I'm selective about the food I eat, and I also exercise and have a good metabolism. So one would think that if you, in training, consume enormous amounts of food, that you just become a big fat tub. Well, no, that's not always the case. And that illustrates that, you know, this whole, what we criticize a lot, this thermodynamic equation, you know, calories in, calories out, is for the birds, because it's not,
That's true.
Has a lot to do with your metabolism. It also has to do with absorption. And if you overeat, sometimes you malabsorb. You know, the food passes very quickly through your body and you don't even absorb it.
I even wonder for those, I mean, you have to train for that hot dog eating contest.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you imagine that these people are throwing it back up after they've, quote, exercised. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's particularly worrisome, because to intentionally cultivate bulimia, that is a very bad, very bad kind of situation, because it's a very destructive emotional disorder that afflicts possibly millions of Americans. I mean, particularly young women. But we recently saw a young man who suffers from that condition. And, you know, it's like you indulge in food that you know is bad for you, but you expiate your sin by putting your finger in the back of the mouth or hanging over a toilet, and then you throw it back up. And that is a very, very, very bad mental circuitry to cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this notion that we can purge away our sins in some way. That way, because, I mean, it leads to all kinds of problems. It leads to GERD. It leads to dental problems. It leads to malnutrition.
Enamel erosion.
But it also it also is part of a real psychopathology, which is very really damages your self-esteem.
You know, coming back to the hot dog eating man, at the end of the contest, for how long do the judges follow them around to make sure they don't throw up?
I don't even want to know. I mean, I don't even want to know.
I don't want to know either, because I've never watched it. I can't watch this.
Right,
I can't watch it.
Yeah.
I become nauseated. Yeah,
right, right.
anyway, we keep coming back to that. We're intrigued.
Yeah.
All right. So, we've got an email from Randy. Randy actually has two questions. Randy writes, I was recently diagnosed with polyneuropathy. It is idiopathic. I've had many tests. I had blood work for heavy metals. They were low, but the doctor wants to do a heavy metal challenge test anyway, mm-hmm. which is a good idea. Mm-hmm. My question, Dr. Hoffman, is you recently had a guest, Dr. Barbara Roberts, who mm-hmm. suggested that statins could cause neuropathy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And Randy says, I bought her book, and she cites a study where statin users had a 26 times higher incidence of idiopathic neuropathy
yep.
versus non-statin users.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Randy quit taking his Lipitor,
right.
40 milligram, in favor
of
other
dose.
Lifestyle modifications.
That's a high dose. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And do you think this was a wise move? I'm a 60-year-old male, and I have an Agatston score of 44.
Okay, so, look, I'm not going to weigh in yeah. with a second opinion on this, because that's exactly why people
yeah.
come to the office. And I do this,
yeah.
and as
yeah.
you know, all the time, a second opinion on whether you need to be on statins. The score of 44 indicates that there's some plaque, but not a lot of plaque. This is a relatively young individual, so one might hypothesize that, you know, if you want to, they live another 35 years, and during that 35 years, you could be at high risk for heart disease, so take a statin. 40 milligrams is quite a lot. I'm not sure why you'd start with such a high dose, potentiating a lot of side effects. You can do Lipitor 10, or you can do Crestor 5 and get, you know, about 80% of the benefits. Or alternatively, not take a statin and engage in very aggressive lifestyle modification, really careful diet, exercise, the right supplements, chiolic aged garlic extract, resveratrol, vitamin K, omega-3 fatty acids,
magnesium,
CoQ10, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that's just scratching the surface. So, you know, the question is, will the polyneuropathy relent with the removal of the statin? So sometimes the damage is pretty permanent or almost irreversible, and sometimes there is improvement. So it's when you have a symptom, you know, whether it's muscle aches or whether it's fatigue or memory problems or insomnia, in some cases even sexual problems, they can be related to statin use. And unless there's a super compelling reason to use statins, like you've had, you know, multiple heart attacks, you know, just the use of statins for prevention, it isn't very preventive anyway. So you're not missing out too much. I mean, mostly the effects are seen in people who've already had demonstrable heart disease, not just a little minor accumulation of plaque, which is kind of a average situation or even better than the average for a 60-year-old male.
Let me ask you, I think the half-life on any of these statins is what, about 6 weeks, or am I confusing that with antidepressants?
No, it's not. It actually will be out of your system within probably days, if not hours. It's that the damage that they mm-hmm. create might take a while to repair.
Could that damage, do you think it could be helped by B12 shots?
Sure.
Alpha-lipoic acid,
yes.
Alpha-lipoic acid, yeah.
Yeah.
Things of that nature.
Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And besides being tested for heavy metals, which he has yet
acetyl L-carnitine is sometimes helpful for neuropathy.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there
All
could
right.
be an autoimmune well, basis. There could be an autoimmune basis for it. You know, that hasn't been, you know, usually idiopathic neuropathy, which is a fancy word meaning nobody knows why it's occurred, is the result of an autoimmune process that selectively attacks the peripheral nerves. But, you know, that is something that I think anyone who suffers from that has been told, hey, you know, this is it, that's all we can do for you, deserves a shot at an integrative practitioner to see if we can roll back the symptoms.
Yeah. Randy has another question for us with regard to heavy metals. Is there any concern that the heavy metals removed from bone and other places via chelation therapy could end up being deposited in the brain?
And that's a good question. And in fact, we have that concern, and that's one of the reasons why during chelation, you know, we give you nutrients that actually help to prevent that. But, you know, it's almost like asbestos removal. You know, asbestos is a big problem, but, you know, if you leave it in place and it's sealed in,
And you don't budget. Yet.
Yeah, then it's it's less problematic than if, say, a unqualified dentist removes your fillings and disperses it all through your bloodstream, and then it, some of it may travel to your brain. So you have to be careful in the process of chelation. Generally, chelation so thoroughly binds these things that there's little danger that you're going to free up a lot of free lead mercury. By its very nature, you're chelating it. You're actually binding it. So it's less likely to become disassociated from the chelate, which is EDTA, or DMSA. And, you know, that's going to find its way to your kidneys and out of your body. So it's less likely to be a problem. But that is a good question.
Yeah. Randy also comments that he recently listened to one of the podcasts on Alzheimer's disease, and it sounds as if the amyloid plaque that forms happens around heavy metals. And I want to bring up the topic of aluminum for a minute. A lot of people, I know it's either been not debunked quite, the aluminum question mark in Alzheimer's, but the source of aluminum, more people have been throwing away their aluminum pots and pans, which is fine. I'm in favor of stainless steel and all of that kind of thing. But people don't realize that our biggest source of aluminum, besides in the air, pollution and manufacturing, is in our antiperspirants.
Yep. Aluminum hydroxide is a drying agent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that would be the first thing to discontinue if anybody is concerned about getting aluminum and concerned about, you know, possible contribution to Alzheimer's.
Good. Well, thanks for that question. This is a good time to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. Layla, give us a little bit of a tease to what we're going to tackle in part two.
What are all these herbicides and pesticides doing to our intestinal flora?
All right. When we return, coming up, part two of today's Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.